This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As we blow up the atmosphere.
You click through scandal and cat pictures and the war.
There must be something else.
There is. It is outside your door, waiting for you. Step outside if you dare, because carbon bombs are falling. In the U.S. Southwest last week, 40 million Americans got summer heat in winter. 5,000 feet up, 1,600 meters near the Rocky Mountains, meteorologist Chris Bianchi did his 9 News TV weather report in swim trunks. It was 85 degrees Fahrenheit, 29 C, in March, which is winter. The all-time U.S. March heat record set in Rio Grande City, Texas, was in March 30, 1954. It was 108 degrees Fahrenheit, 42 C. That was broken on the 19th of March this year with 110 degrees Fahrenheit at Martinez Lake, Arizona. That is 43.3 C. Going back to the 1800s when records began, it has never been hotter in March in the United States. It has never been hotter in winter in the United States. With a fast computer, a group of scientists at worldweatherattribution.org showed this giant heat dome carrying temperatures 11 to 17 degrees C, 20 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than average for March, across more than a dozen states, over half a continent, in fact. The scientists concluded, quote, events as warm as in March 2026 would have been virtually impossible without human-induced climate change. When you get summer and winter, it is time to admit the awful truth, isn't it? Climate change is here, right now, no matter what humans think they are doing with the business and the war, online gaming, whatever. We all need to learn how this beast works and what to expect. In this program, two great scientists explain the speeding heat pump. The ocean as a capacitor, pushing us hotter, step by step. Don't miss Dr. Kevin Trenberth, distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, on Radio EcoShock, explaining ocean heat storage, El Niño, and just the way the world works, unseen from our position on land. Then from Columbia University, Dr. Susanna Camargo, on the future of hurricanes, or call them typhoons or cyclones. They cause more than fear and damage. Big storms leave a wake of changed weather, and they drive the distribution of heat and water toward the poles. Tropical cyclones are bigger than we thought. Tune out the propaganda drumbeat. Tune in, top scientists, talking to you about how the real world works and how it's changing now and for centuries to come. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
90% of all the extra heat being absorbed by this planet goes where? Into the ocean. That heat will come back out. When? And how fast? Is it unstoppable? For that, we go to one of the most published scientific authors on ocean heat and the atmosphere. He is Dr. Kevin Trenberth. He is a distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. From New Zealand, Kevin Trenberth, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
You co-authored or authored multiple studies on ocean heat just in the last year. There's lots to talk about, but I would like to start with a theory posted by UK climate science writer Tom Harris and researcher Jan Umsonst. They worry more heat is piling into the upper layer of the ocean, where it overloads and releases in bursts of heat, and that accelerates warming on land. I sent you the Substack article called The Great Decoupling, How Ocean Stratification is Boosting Global Warming. What do you think, Kevin?
Yes, well, we have written two major articles. One just came out in Nature Science Reviews, all about changes in stratification. And so that's one of the things about the ocean. Given the extra heat that's available, the heating occurs from the top down, and the ocean is already stratified. The coldest water, just above freezing, is at the bottom of the ocean. The freezing point of salt water is about -2 degrees Celsius. So it's close to freezing point in the very, very deep ocean. And then in the upper ocean, it's a lot warmer. And so it's already warm water on top of cold water. And then we're warming the warm water at the top even more. So it increases the temperature gradient. And that often gets focused in a region below what is called the mixed layer, which is where winds stir up the ocean and tides help to mix it around and ocean currents mix it up. And so that's where a lot of the focus occurs. And that has big impacts on the exchanges of water within the ocean. And the water, of course, includes all kinds of nutrients and oxygen and carbon dioxide and so on. And so it affects all of the organisms within the ocean in particular.
Yes, I checked out that paper in Nature, Ocean Stratification in a Warming Climate. That was in September. And I wanted to ask, is stratification expected to change with global warming?
So there's no reason for it not to continue to increase. The penetration of heat within the ocean is quite slow. It takes 2 or 3 decades to get down to about 2 kilometers depth, and we can see this over time. So we see the warming of the ocean beginning in the 1970s near the surface, and then it penetrates down to 1,000 meters after about 20 years, and it takes about 25 years to go down to 2,000 meters or so. And we can actually track that. And this is one of the challenges, of course, for climate modeling as to whether they can replicate that properly.
As we speak, the Gulf of Mexico is almost record hot again. Are there other recent ocean hot spots around the world that drew your attention?
Yes, there have been several, and they're evolving all the time. So what happens is the ocean takes up heat. But it does create hot spots, often called marine heat waves, and that attracts extra activity in the atmosphere. There's a lot more convection that tends to occur in that region, and if it's in the tropics, then tropical cyclones can actually form over or very close to those regions, and then it takes heat out of the ocean, mainly through evaporative cooling of the ocean, and moistening the atmosphere, and then when that moisture condenses in the atmosphere, it releases latent heat and heats up the atmosphere. And so it gets moved around by the atmosphere, and then somewhere else it goes into the ocean, or there's compensation through cloudiness in the areas where there's a lot more convection and tropical storms and so on. It blocks the sun, and meanwhile, somewhere else, perhaps not that far away, it's very sunny, and so heat goes into the ocean. So it's quite a dynamic process, this business of the ocean taking up heat and gradually penetrating it down to lower levels. In the meanwhile, of course, what this does is it excites all of the atmospheric activity, and it makes the storms stronger and the rainfall heavier.
Well, we hear a lot about the impacts in North American weather or in Europe. What about China, Kevin? Are there changes in ocean heat affecting China as well?
Yes, well, the ocean off of China is off the east coast, and most of the weather systems flow from west to east. And so it's more the what's going on in China affecting the Pacific Ocean and the region out by Japan and so on. And certainly in the 60s to 80s and maybe up to even 2010, there was a lot of pollution in China, which also came out over the ocean and blocked the sun. And that has now largely been cleaned up, or it's been cleaned up a great deal. And so that's cut down on the pollution, and it means there's more sunshine coming through to the ocean in that region. And, of course, that has influences then on tropical cyclones, and certainly in the lower latitudes, there is a lot of tropical cyclone activity. And late last year, there were three tropical cyclones that went through the southern parts of Asia, through Thailand and all the way across to India, and caused a tremendous amount of flooding and a lot of damage. And southern China was affected by that as well. So China has become certainly more aware over time that climate change is important for China. And that's one of the reasons they've cleaned up their atmosphere. But they're still emitting a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So global warming continues.
What does the balance of salt and freshwater have to do with marine heat retention?
Yes, so indeed, the density of the ocean depends on both of those things. It depends on the salinity and it depends on the temperature. And so in general, if it's very salty, then the density is greater. If it's very cold, the density is greater. So cold and salty water often in the past has prevailed at higher latitudes, and then that it tends to sink. But as you warm up the upper ocean, there's this competition between it being quite salty, and the saltiness can be enhanced by the formation of ice, because ice tends to reject the brine, and the ice tends to be less salty than the surrounding water, and that increases the density. So you've got these competing effects of increases in density from increasing salt, but also some warming going on. And that can affect then the overturning circulations within the ocean, the things that are often referred to as the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, which involves in part the Gulf Stream, for instance.
So do you think there's a relationship between large-scale changes in atmospheric winds as warming develops and warmer oceans? Are they working together or in different ways?
Yes, they certainly are. The atmospheric winds are the primary thing that drives the ocean and the ocean currents. Ocean density itself plays some role, and that has in the past often been referred to as the thermohaline circulation is what we're talking about. So thermo refers to the temperature aspects, and the haline refers to the salt aspects. And in general, that's a large-scale circulation throughout the global oceans that can be affected by both changes in saltiness and the density, and also by changes in temperature. And in turn, where the warm water occurs in the ocean has profound effects on the atmosphere and then on the winds. And so it's a very strong interactive process. The best example of the interactions is where the ocean responds very quickly, and that's in the tropics and referred to as the El Nino phenomenon. And that is a very strongly coupled atmosphere-ocean process.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, the leading authority on oceans, atmosphere, and climate change. We're talking about how ocean heat changes climate, affecting everyone across the planet. Kevin, there's a debate within science. Do you think warming is accelerating?
There's some evidence of that. And of course, there has been a huge acceleration from the 1970s through to 2000, where warming really got cranked up. But since about 2000, the acceleration in the ocean heat content is not very evident. It's more evident in the sea level rise. The sea level rise in the early 1990s was about 3 millimeters per year, and now it's at least 4 and maybe a little higher than 4 millimeters per year. Clear evidence of acceleration in the sea level rise. There is acceleration in the global mean surface temperature. So this is the air temperature, and there's been some recent papers published about this. it's unclear whether one should regard it as an acceleration or whether it's more like jumps to higher levels. And I've written a little bit about this, and especially with the El Nino phenomenon. In the tropics, during the normal conditions or in the La Nina phase, the heat goes into the ocean and it gets stored up in the tropical Western Pacific, which gets a very big, deep, warm pool until the sea level goes up there, and then the ocean can no longer stand that because of the sea level differences, and so currents form, and it has an El Nino event and moves the heat around in the ocean, and some of that comes back into the atmosphere, mainly through evaporative cooling of the ocean and through the rainfall in the atmosphere. And global surface temperature sort of jumps up, and the warmest years on record are El Nino years. But it seems in quite a number of examples in recent years that it never quite returns to the previous level. And so there's a series of jumps that seem to be triggered by El Nino events, and that certainly this happened in 2023, and 2024 was then the warmest year on record. 2025 dropped down a little bit, and now we've got another El Nino coming along in 2026. To me, it looks a little bit like an analog of 2023 and 2024, and so it'll get warmer in the second half of this year again, and you're already seeing parts of that in the United States with a big, warm dome and not much snow, especially in the western parts of the U.S., and so this is already underway in a way. And then the prospects are that 2027 could be even a little bit warmer still, although usually it's, again, only the first half of 2027. And so whether 2026 or 2027 ends up being the warmest overall depends a little bit on the onset and how quickly it fades out again.
And what about reduced cloud cover, like opening an iris, as described by Richard Lindzen in 2001? Is cloud cover showing up, say, in ocean heating? Is there something going on there?
Oh, yes. This is an important and not very well understood feedback. So clouds are clearly important. And Richard Lindzen wrote about this in the early 1990s, but he got it actually quite wrong. What is expected in general is that because there's more moisture in the atmosphere and more heat in the ocean, is that the convection gets stronger and taller, and therefore also a bit narrower, and there's a lot more massive air going up into the atmosphere, and then it has to come down somewhere, and so there's a broader region of subsidence and subsiding air. And that cuts out the clouds. And so there's broader regions of relatively cloud-free areas. And that means there's more sunshine coming in, but there's also more heat going out. And in Lindzen's paper, he emphasized that there was more of an iris opening that would allow the heat to escape to space. And what he forgot about completely was it also opens up the skies to incoming solar radiation, and there's good evidence now that that is happening. And so as the climate is changing, there has been a shift polewards in both hemispheres of the jet stream and the main storm tracks over the ocean. And so in the northern hemisphere, over the Pacific and the Atlantic, there's good evidence to show that both have tended to shift further to the north, and that has had consequences of opening up the skies in the tropics and subtropics in particular. There's more radiation coming in, and we can measure that from the top of the atmosphere. And so this is an extra complication on simply changes in carbon dioxide and changes in the greenhouse effect, because this is the other side of the coin. This is the solar radiation that's being affected, and it turns out it seems to be having quite profound influences, and that is what is leading to the acceleration of climate change at the moment.
So heating the vast ocean is a slow process. If humans manage to cut greenhouse gas emissions sooner rather than later, would that make much difference to ocean heat?
Well, ultimately it does, but as you say, it's a very slow process, and so that the disappointing thing is that if you make big changes now and cut down on emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the main benefits you see are probably 50 to 100 years from now rather than next week or next year. And this is one of the things which some people then say, well, that's not my lifetime. Why should I worry about it? And so it depends then how much your value system, how much you worry about the future generations and the future climate of the world as a whole and the ability to grow adequate crops and feed all of the population and so on. So value systems come into play when you start to talk about that kind of thing.
How fast will ocean heat be released into the atmosphere? Would it be noticeable within a decade, and would it go on for centuries?
There's certainly one aspect of what's going on which is related to heating, and that is to say that if you increase the heating either through increases in carbon dioxide or by cutting down on the clouds and the reflection from ice and so on, then that helps invigorate some of the weather systems. If you turn off the extra heating, it still remains hot. The oceans are warmer than they used to be, and that means it affects the evaporation. It certainly affects the water cycle, the hydrological cycle, and the rainfall. And so there is a change in the climate, but it may be that the extremes are not quite as bad as they otherwise would be. So there could well be some benefits, but even if we were to stop the increases in carbon dioxide now, it's expected that sea level rise would continue for 200 years or 250 years before that really stabilized. And so some aspects of the climate change have very long timescales attached to it, which is all the more reason why we need to take action sooner.
You know, I'm learning that distribution of ocean heat depends on factors like wind, certainly, but also upper layer motions called eddies. And there's a lot of new science on eddies coming out, particularly led by Chinese scientists, and the ocean swirling with them. Could the ocean become more placid in a warming world, and what would that mean?
So some of this is simply related to density changes that occur within the ocean. But a lot of the eddies, the most vigorous eddies, are associated with currents, like the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream is always spinning off eddies, both cyclonic and anticyclonic. And that is to say, they can spin off in different directions in terms of their rotation, and they can have quite profound effects on the local sea life, fisheries and plant growth, seaweeds and surface layers in particular. And that occurs in other places, so the Kuroshio in the North Pacific off the coast of Asia, and also the strong currents all around the southern oceans around Antarctica are where the strongest eddies tend to occur. But they are pervasive. You can find eddies all throughout the ocean. And the climate models now are beginning to simulate some of these, but they have to have quite high resolution. And part of it, of course, is just kicking up the ocean because of all of the weather systems that are going on above.
Just as climate is smashing America with weird winter heat waves, drought, wildfires, crazy storms, the Trump administration is closing America's premier institute for research into the atmosphere, NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and it's in Boulder, Colorado. What are we losing here, Kevin, if that happens?
Well, I hope it's not going to happen, but as you said, this is part of the administration's plan, and they have indeed indicted the fact that NCAR has played a role in climate modeling. They have a major supercomputer center, but NCAR has been quite diverse, and it has many activities, and has played a major role in training young scientists and interacting with the 197 or so member universities of UCAR, the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, which runs NCAR. And there has been very strong support that, indeed, NCAR should exist and continue to exist. One of the unique things about NCAR, and I think it is unique anywhere in the world, is that it pulls together everything from the very smallest scales of weather, and there's one division that they call the microscale meteorology division, middle-scale microscale meteorology division, which really deals with small-scale weather. There's a section which has dealt with airports and aviation and all of the turbulence that can occur around airplanes. There's another small section that deals with wildfires, for instance, and how you better predict them and deal with them. And the model that has been developed, the Community Earth System model, that is used to simulate the global climate on long time scales and look at aspects of climate change and understand what is going on, that is available to all of the universities in the United States and even around the world. It's being widely used. And so it's one of the few places where all aspects actually come together and scientists can actually talk to one another dealing with all of these things. And so you can go and find somebody else who can deal with some of the small details which you may not be able to fully comprehend, for instance. And it's very important to have an institution that does that kind of thing. And it would be a huge loss if that were to occur. And it would really set back the science in the U.S. and the leadership in the U.S. for probably a couple of generations.
And finally, as we speak, at least 25% of the world's oil supply has been cut off by the war on Iran. Last week, I dared to ask, could this be a good thing for climate? It's a horrible war, but it might reduce consumption and emissions and force a switch to renewable energy. What do you think, Kevin, and how has the oil shock affected people in New Zealand?
Well, in New Zealand, it's, I live in New Zealand now, and New Zealand is extremely dependent upon trade. All of the shipping that takes New Zealand's exports to the markets around the world and then imports all sorts of things, including oil and petroleum products. And there's already a surcharge on container ships and on many ships. Ships can no longer go through the Strait of Hormuz, and if they go around Africa in order to get to Australia and New Zealand, it takes them an extra 2 or 3 weeks and adds to the costs considerably. So this is the sort of thing which is very expensive for New Zealand, and New Zealand has not done a good job in recent times in making themselves more self-sufficient. I have argued that they should do so, and we should indeed decarbonize our economy and become more dependent only on renewables. Solar and wind are not as well developed here as they ought to be, in my view. There is a very strong, I think something like 85% of New Zealand's electricity is actually generated through hydroelectric power and also in part through geothermal electricity. And so it has been quite strong, but the intermittency of solar and wind has been a turnoff here, and yet it's being dealt with a lot more in other places like Germany and the UK and others that have even less sunshine than New Zealand. And so I think New Zealand has been running right behind, and this is going to have a very profound effect here. And I've got a column coming out on this. It's in press, actually, at the moment, and probably come out on Monday.
We have been talking with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, a leading specialist in oceans and the atmosphere. Kevin published hundreds of highly cited scientific papers, and he's still at it, now from New Zealand. It's hard to keep up with Kevin's work, but we try. Thank you so much for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Alex, and for all you do with Radio Echo Shop.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Temporary extremes can leave big impacts. Call them hurricanes, typhoons, or tropical cyclones, as scientists do. They crash quickly through our lives, leaving a trail of damages. But we are just beginning to discover these big storms are a much bigger part of how the climate works. They change global energy and water. And this is a fundamental to understanding, I think, of how cyclones work on this planet. At Columbia University in New York, Susanna Camargo is a professor of climate, and she's at the Climate School. Educated in Brazil and Germany, Camargo is widely published and respected in her field. She continues to teach and mentor young scientists. Along with Kevin Trenberth, Camargo is a co-author of the new paper, Interactions of Tropical Cyclones with Global Energy and Water Cycles. From New York, Susanna Camargo, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
We think of tropical cyclones as short events, just a few days and then they're over. Introduce us to a couple of ways these big storms last longer in their impacts on the local region and the atmosphere.
We have always thought about tropical cyclones as a way in which the climate system of the Earth is able to transport energy from the tropics towards the mid-latitudes. That's why tropical cyclones exist, to help this transport, because we have, most of the energy of the sun coming in the tropics, and that, to balance the energy in the Earth, we have to transport that across the climate system, and there are various ways to do that, and the tropical cyclones is one way to do that. And now we have the ability to more measurements and theory and modeling to understand that better. So one way you can actually see that is, for instance, after you have a strong hurricane or typhoon passing through a certain region, you can clearly see through satellite pictures this wake of cold water that it's in the back after the typhoon or hurricane passes. And that cold water will stay there. These cold lakes, they can last for a while. They can then influence weather in the region. They can and have lots of effects that last longer time. So this is, one way to think about it.
You talk about the cooling wake in the ocean, and that leads me to what I think is a common misunderstanding. We hear about that and we think, okay, tropical cyclones are a cooling mechanism on this warming planet, but that isn't really true, is it? They're just moving it somewhere else, the heat.
Exactly. So it's getting all this energy that's in the tropics where they form. As they move towards higher latitudes, they're taking all that energy with them. And that, you can see the effect, for instance, in various aspects of the climate, in particular, you look at the ocean circulation, you look at the atmosphere. We had something called, for instance, Rossby waves, which is like you can think about like you see waves in the ocean, you can also have waves in the atmosphere. So when you have this hurricane happening, it basically helps generate this wave train. And this wave train, you're going to influence the weather far away from where this hurricane or this typhoon happened. So it's like multiple ways that the hurricanes and typhoons can influence the water cycle, influence, radiation, influence everything on Earth.
You're making it sound like the cyclones actually have a function on Earth, which is a bit like an overload system, so that so much energy builds up around the tropics that it has to release itself through these cyclones. Do we understand why there are cyclones on this planet, really?
Well, I think that's part of it. The cyclones exist for to make the this transport of energy. For instance, even when we have, you know, very simplistic, very old climate models, you know, in the 60s and 70s, you start even, you know, which are based on the equations that physics equations that determine what's happening in the atmosphere and the ocean, you already have forming instantaneously in these climate models these features that look like tropical cyclones. Of course, they can't be, you know, at that resolution that we had of those climate models. They couldn't really simulate tropical cyclones, but they appear automatically when you try to simulate the climate of the Earth, not only of the Earth. You can have features, you know, not with, you know, with rotation and things like that in other planets as well. So that's part of the physics of the atmosphere. They appear. So it is, they are part of, you know, essential part of this transport. Not only tropical cyclones, for instance, when we have, for instance, these northeasterns that happen now, that we have all this snow in the northeast of the U.S., they are also doing that. So winter storms can also help with this transport, you know, having a big precipitation, convection systems, all that help with this transport of energy in the climate system.
Sometimes when I follow cyclones in the news, I'm surprised to find a track of them, like two or three. I saw two or three hit the Philippines in a relatively short period of time. Is there any indication that one big storm can lead to another?
So usually we have some conditions that help the formation there. We need for the formation of tropical cyclones. And some conditions in the atmosphere can lead to a cluster of a lot of storms for a short period and then be quiet for a while. So this is what we call subseasonal timescale. So within the hurricane season, we have periods that are very active and then periods that are less active. And we know some, you know, patterns of the atmosphere, one of them very well known called the Madden-Julian Oscillation, that leads to this clustering of occurrence of hurricanes or typhoons. So basically, the Madden-Julian Oscillation is this big region that has a lot of convection and rainfall, and it starts usually in the Indian Ocean and moves towards the Atlantic. And wherever you have this region of very active, the Madden-Julian Oscillation, when the Madden-Julian is active, then you tend to have a lot of typhoons or hurricanes forming during that period. And that as it moves eastward, then it would be calm in that region and start being more active in that region that's now located. So this is a very well-known phenomena, and that's why, you know, people like me, we try to use that to see we can do forecasts at those shorter time scales, not the whole season, not the weather scales, but something in between. So can I say that, you know, the next 2 weeks are going to be very active or the next week is going to be very active? So we do have this sometimes this clustering of activity, and we understand some of the causes that lead to them.
Right. For listeners used to hearing weather is not climate, how do you explain that a collection of extreme weather events like tropical cyclones could add up to a climate scale effect?
When we look at the climate impact, we're not looking at one specific storm. We look at the whole season in some basin like the Atlantic or the Western North Pacific, or we look, you know, at the whole globe, how we do through a year, and then we look at that for many seasons, many years, and then we start to have an idea how this relationship with climate and tropical cyclones evolve. That happens part of natural variability. For instance, El Niño Southern Oscillation, which is a very well-known phenomena, influence hurricane activity in the Atlantic, a typhoon activity in the Western Pacific. So when you have an El Niño event, which is this warmth in the tropical Pacific, typically then you tend to have an Atlantic season that's less active. So you have fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic. And that's because the El Nino event changed the patterns of the winds. And then how it changed the pattern of the winds leads to fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic. And the El Nino tends to last, you know, typically, you know, many months. So if you know that the El Nino event is happening, then you know that there's a higher probability of the Atlantic hurricane season being less active than normal. That's exactly what's happening right now. So right now, there's a forecast of an El Nino happening this 2026-2027. And if that actually happens, then the forecast for the next Atlantic hurricane season will be for less active than usual. So it doesn't mean that we are not going to have any Atlantic hurricanes, or there is no probability of a very intense hurricane that could lead to a lot of damage. But, you know, that's all in terms of probabilities, like you go to the casino, right? So basically you have your playing with your dice, and then, you know, instead of having 1/6 probability in each side, El Nino is making some sides having a higher probability than others. Doesn't mean that the side that has a lower probability is not going to happen, but there's a lower chance that that's going to happen. So we know that, you know, tropical cyclones are affected by all these modes of climate variability. They're intrinsic of the climate system. That's natural variability. And that has been happening forever. So that's why it's important when we, you know, there's a hurricane happening and people say, whoa, what's the role of climate change? We have been very careful how we ask that question, because, you know, climate change doesn't cause a hurricane to happen. Hurricanes happen all the time, with or without climate change. What the question we can consider is, like, is climate change modifying the characteristics of this event? And if, how, you know, about how much can we say? So this is this combination of the interaction of climate at various time scales, from the Madden-Julian oscillation that lasts a few months to, you know, El Nino sudden oscillation to which lasts, you know, almost a year, to, you know, many, you know, climate variability that lasts in decadal time scales, to then climate change that's a much longer time scale. So that's why it's complicated, because we have to be analyzing this interaction at all these time scales.
A friend of mine says we live in the climate casino, and everybody wants to know whether violent storms will get even stronger, or will they come more often as our emissions heat up the world? What do you think?
So, you know, that's one of the things I have been studying for a long time, and I think the community has a very clear answer for many of the aspects of how climate change has influenced hurricanes and typhoons. Not all the aspects, but for instance, some of them are very clear. For instance, we are seeing more intense hurricanes and more intense typhoons happening with time. So we're having more of these Cat 4 and Cat 5 storms. So the proportion of them compared with what we used to have in the past is increasing. And we understand that. We have very good theory. We see in the observations, all the models do that very well. Then we also know that because in a warmer world, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. So we know that it's possible to have more of these extreme precipitation events, not only hurricanes, other any kind of extreme precipitation events. So similarly to other extreme precipitation events, we can have, you know, more mean rainfall and also the more extreme rainfall associated with in a warmer climate. Another very clear aspect is related to sea level rise. So if we have sea level rise, even if we had exactly the same hurricane, if we had storm surge, that would lead to a higher level of flooding, because, you know, you have the flooding that would be expected, that you'd be associated with that storm, but then you have put a certain amount of sea level rise on top of that. So these are factors that are very well known. In terms of numbers, that's one of the aspects that is very active in terms of research. You know, the most models project having fewer hurricanes and typhoons in the future globally, not by in the specific region, that the uncertainty is too big, but in some different types of modeling and can lead to actually more storms. So that's, and we are trying to understand why is it that are these difference, can we then narrow down if we're going to have more or fewer? But even if you have, like, you know, let's say we have a decrease of 10% of the number of tropical cyclones globally, you still have so many, and if you could, and some of those could be these very destructive ones. So we see when we just have a couple of them that make landfall and they're very strong or made cause a lot of flooding, then, you know, this destruction is very big and can lead to a lot of socioeconomic impact. So this counting is on some end not so important. Is, you know, if we are having these storms that are more intense in terms of winds, they're bringing more rainfall, leading a lot of flooding, that's very important. We cannot forget, though, that we are making ourselves more vulnerable for these events as well. So it's not only what's happening in terms of climate. If you, you know, put more people, more infrastructure in locations that have a high chance of being affected by hurricane or typhoons, we are increasing the chance of having these big disasters. So it's not only what the climate change is doing, but also what we are doing in terms of what we call exposure and vulnerability. So you can imagine, you know, the Great Miami Hurricane that happened in the early 20th century happening exactly now, exactly the same storm. So no climate change story there. Just because we have, you know, Miami has increased multiple times, and the number of people, all the buildings, all the bridges, roads, everything, so the impact, the socioeconomic impact would be multiple times bigger, and that's part of the story too. So when we are analyzing the impacts of these storms in terms of socioeconomic impacts, this is part of the story as well. We cannot blame everything on climate change.
No, that's true with fires too, wildfires. People are moving into forested areas, and then, of course, you get more damage and more homes burned because they're right there in the fire zone.
Exactly.
When I'm looking at different aspects of climate, I'm always having an eye out for feedbacks. I'm wondering if there could be any here. I mean, could changes in cyclone statistics under global warming, if they do happen, could those feed back into the climate system itself? Did you find any signs of feedbacks in your reviews?
I think that's a little hard to do at this point. I think we have, could be, but, you know, I think these signals are still, I think, hard to see. For multiple reasons, you know, I think we need better data for tropical cyclones globally, both in the atmosphere and in the ocean. You know, just in a few basins, we fly into hurricanes, and these are is the best data that we can gather is when we fly into hurricanes and we gather data inside the storm. And then in the ocean, we just have very spotted data. So if we, for instance, if we're going to see feedbacks, the ocean has to be clearly part of the story. And I don't think we have enough data for that. And also, you know, we have about 80 storms per year, and they are in specific locations every year. So for us to start to see these feedbacks, we have, you know, really to, I think, we improve both our data quality, data amount of data, and also improve our understanding in terms of modeling and all this process. So I think that we are doing progress in those, in terms of looking at these feedbacks, but I think we still have a lot to understand.
Susanna, are there misconceptions in policy or in media talk about hurricanes and climate that you wish that your work could help correct?
Well, I think I don't like exaggerating the role of climate change, like discounting the role that we are doing by building houses in the path of hurricanes and things like that. But also we cannot ignore them. We have to be careful when we are thinking in terms of policy, considering both what we're doing in terms of climate change, but also what we're doing in terms of development, in terms of our policy to where people should live, and insurance and things like that. Think that we have to be careful when we do policy, because these are things that are intrinsically linked. They are not separate. And as I said, they know there is a role for climate change, but I do not like also to try to exaggerate that, to try to make politicians listen to us. We have to be careful. We don't want to be the boy calling wolf and exaggerate the impacts and exaggerate what we know and what we don't know.
I hear you, but I think we have the opposite problem, that nobody's crying wolf when we do have a developing climate emergency, not just with hurricanes, but with all sorts of things. I mean, look at the weather in the West right now. Summer in winter when you get to the Western United States. Well, look, as we wrap this up, what are you and your colleagues working on next, and where can listeners find out more?
What are we working on? We are working a lot with tropical cyclone risk and try to understand this combination of climate change and try to put together the socioeconomic impacts, try to look at combined impacts of wind risk and flooding risk. So all these things that we are trying to work together, we are working together with the private industry because they're very worried about that. Reinsurance companies, for instance, they really worried about these issues. So it's a combination of understanding the physics of climate cyclones. At the same time, we put together models that can look in more detail the impacts into infrastructure and social economy, things like that.
From Columbia University, we've been speaking with Dr. Susanna Camargo. Susanna is co-author of a major new review of tropical cyclones called Interactions of Tropical Cyclones with Global Energy and Water Cycles. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Susanna, thank you for your insights and for talking with us.
Very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If we really crank it up, are we really confident we're topping at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7? Or, you know, it's you can think of a burn it all future getting really hot.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
Isn't it strange to see the staid International Energy Agency publishing tips on how to save money during the Middle East oil and gas crash? Use public transit, work from home, fly less. You think? We've been saying that for years. Two quick things as we wrap up. This energy squeeze is not temporary. Some production infrastructure wrecked in the Gulf War will take up to 5 years to repair, according to the government in Qatar. Shipping will take a long time to rebalance. More people and countries will turn to cheap renewables. Plus, a crash of consumer demand and an economic depression could cripple the consumer's ability to go back to those fossil-burning days. Second thing, it's just not enough. The proposals to cope with the Middle East shutdown are tiny band-aids, nowhere near enough. When we get summer and winter, violent storms, drought threatening millions, a long list of damages, then we know this really is a climate emergency. I assume gas prices in America could reach European levels, so maybe $8 to $10 a gallon. Already news reports show airport security workers not showing up because they can't afford the gas to the airport. America built affordable living hours away from workplaces with no walkable shops, giant gas-guzzling cars as the solution. Where people must drive to live, and only the rich can afford the gas, then it is time for gas rationing. We don't need cards in a digital age. Some people get gas rations that don't need them so they can sell them to others. That's fine. But overall use and emissions are capped, and the cap gets lowered every year. This is wartime, but not with each other. We need wartime emergency action to save a livable climate now for our kids, for our descendants. Ban private flights. Invest in mass transit and divest from fossil fuels. Return national bus service. Rebuild railways. Buy less. Use less. That is where every country needs to be, starting yesterday. There is no time left to keep killing each other. No time left for blowing up cities or fighting for male dominance over and over. The only winners are climate survivors. We are the ones to become those survivors. The living world you save may be your own. That's how I see it. Thank you for listening when many won't. Keep caring for each other, won't you?
I'm gonna let you go into the heat. I'll drive around to see it. I'll fly around to make it. I'll live the way it always was. I'm in the driver's seat for the heat. Inheritance loaned on the cheap. Never know, never wake up to the heat. Driving to compete for the heat. Joy.